Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left at Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis. You all right?
How are you this morning?
You okay, man?
I'm distressed at the state of the world. I'm distressed at the state of the world.
Yeah, I am distressed a little bit at the state of the world as
Not
well.
Only do we have an author going to come join us, Wendy Orend has written a book about plague.
We're not going to talk that much about plague.
No, cool. We're going to talk about bird flu.
Oh, okay, that's better.
We'll see how we tie that into the restaurant, guys. We'll start with a little silliness.
We can talk about anything, can't we?
Well, yeah, we'll talk about a little more banality. You ready for this? Here's an article that was in Decanter Magazine, the British publication, recently. If you like the aroma of Sauvignon Blanc enough to rub it on your neck and smell it all evening, CIVB chief Christian Delpouche, I don't know, he's French, something, has just the thing for you.
Something French. We'll call him Christian something French from
yeah,
now on.
I believe it's Delpouche. General director of the Bordeaux Négociant Ginestet, as well as president of the Bordeaux trade body CIVB, has enjoyed worldwide sales of his line of three perfumes derived of wine molecules. That's right, I said perfume derived from wine molecules.
So my wife can smell like wine?
Sauternes lovers can smell their favorite sweet wine with the perfume called Botrytis. It recalls a great Sauternes, sparkling autumnal silk robe of a great Sauternes.
That's awesome. Just kidding.
For wine barrel aroma lovers, there's a Le Boisy, which arrives concealed in a wooden case. The perfume exudes light vanilla touch of oak that is used to age Bordeaux wine.
Okay, but what if I'm having the fish?
But then you will have to sleep with a different woman.
I'm sorry, honey. Can you wear the Sauternes tonight? I'm having foie gras.
Oh, my God. Famously, Ginestet conjured up the scent of Sauvignon Blanc, the grape that smells of grapefruit and peach and box tree aromas.
My wife's got to change perfumes between courses.
Here's a funny part in the article. Sauvignon Blanc has also been described famously, and this is true, as a cat's pee. It's unlikely the perfumes have attempted to recreate that particular aroma. You know, the thing about it is, among serious wine collectors, they've begun to rate their wives. Oh, that's lovely, honey. I'll give you an 85, however. It's not good enough. Go and change. Take a shower. Come back. See if you can get into the 90s.
Where are we going? Where are we going, and how did we get into this handbasket?
Oh, my. Yeah, that's just ridiculous nonsense. So,
thank you for having some ridiculous nonsense for us this morning, Francis.
If you want to smell like wine or cat pee, you can
I have a better idea.
You can have a cat pee on you. Or
why don't we just drink the wine and smell like people?
Oh my! I don't even know where to begin to criticize that.
Yes, you do. You know where to begin.
I mean, it's ridiculous. What's the next line? We could take David Burke's flavor spray.
No.
Spray it on your wife. She can smell like a whole meal.
You could
smell like you have a little red wine. Spread a little beef flavor spray.
I got an idea.
What?
You start the first course. You start at the hands, and you spray their hands a certain flavor, and then like the fleshy part of.
And
the,
we're not even going to talk about the fish. We're not talking about the fish course.
The fleshy part of the arm. You go up a little bit later.
Oh Lord. Okay. I got more.
You have more, I hope, better than that.
I got more. Also from Decanter. Decanter magazine's a great, you can get them online, decanter.com, but to subscribe to them is great because they're a British publication, and their wine critics have a very different perspective, and they have great feature articles, and it's really fun.
It is, and just to talk about Decanter for 1 second, it is a very different perspective than the American wine magazines, and Francis and I leaf through them A, to get a more global perspective of what's going on in the wine world, but just like Francis said, it's a different kind of, their vantage point is different than ours.
They don't say, I smell my wife and I give her a 94. okay, but this also, Mouton Cristal Wagyu Beef, the world's priciest pie, was polished off in Burnley, England. The world's most expensive pie made with two bottles of 82 Mouton Rothschild, the first growth Bordeaux, which were reduced down in a pan to the volume of one. Into the pie also went Japanese Wagyu beef, famed for its unique marketing, at about 500 pounds a kilo. That's $1,000 for 2 pounds, $500 a pound.
Yeah.
There were Chinese mushrooms so rare they're picked under armed guard, black truffles. They put in some 24-karat gold leaf and a couple of bottles of Louis Roeder Cristal to wash it all down. The mushrooms were 2,000 pounds. And that's not the weight, that's the cost.
Wow.
And the Mouton was worth £375 a bottle. The slice of pie was on the menu at £1,000 a slice. There were 8 slices. Add to that the price of the bottle of Cristal Rosé at £200, or about $400 and change. And the meal turned out to be an expensive one.
So, Francis?
Yeah.
I feel like a little bit of a hypocrite.
Uh-huh.
Because we're constantly talking about ingredients, ingredients, ingredients. That's how you make the best food, with great ingredients.
Don't be an idiot.
Unless you're being an idiot with your 82 Mouton.
Except
drink it.
Except that, you know what, the guy paid $10,000 to make a pie that got written about in Decanter magazine, and everybody knows his name. Fence Gate owner Kevin Birkins acknowledged it was somewhat extravagant. Yeah.
You know the ingredient, I'm going to digress for a second because that's what I do best. The ingredient that I just don't understand in anything ever
is
gold leaf.
Yeah, it's stupid.
Gold leaf.
It's decoration.
No flavor. No, it does nothing except add gold leaf.
Yeah, it's decoration. But you know, there's gold leaf in Goldschlager.
Goldschlager. There's a
white wine now out there with gold leaf in it. What's the point?
Why? I don't get it. So you can drink the gold leaf that doesn't really taste like anything.
Well, I think that's what this is really all about. Look, I have a rule we're wine professionals, right? And we actually buy, we spend, you know, a lot of money, millions of dollars on wine, and to buy and sell, you know, for ourselves and for our consulting clients and for other people. So, you know, yes, we talk about wine, and yes, we do, and yes, it's a hobby of ours, and I love it, but. You know, it's funny when you talk about wine with other folks. You know, if it's about a professional thing that's going on, that's interesting. If it's about something you're drinking now, that's interesting. If it's about something you intend to share, that's interesting. Or if it's a story about a wine person, I think that's interesting. But people tend to talk about what's in their cellar. Oh, do you know what I've got at home? Do you know what I had last week? Yeah, and I just I think to myself, are you going to open a bottle for me to try with you now?
It's a lot like when the guy comes up to you and says, you know, I spent $14,000 on my wife's diamond ring.
Yeah, exactly.
It's very similar to that. It's if you're not sharing wine, if you're not experiencing it with somebody else, or even sharing an experience that you had with wine, then I don't know. I just don't like the way it comes across when somebody's just talking about their collection.
And it's not just what comes across. It's, listen, I bought my wife the most beautiful diamond ring that I could find, and I love it, and she loves it, and that made her happy. And look at that diamond ring. I find that to be much more interesting, and I think it's beautiful, you know, as opposed to I bought this big ring to show you how much money I have.
Right.
And, you know, when you
I keep it in my closet at home, never to be enjoyed by anyone. I guess that's the best analogy. It's as if you bought your wife that diamond ring, and you made her keep it at home in the safe, and you never got to wear it.
That's about wine collections. But what this pie is, this is conspicuous consumption, okay? Because you know what? The difference between the 82 Mouton Rothschild and the Mouton Cadet, or maybe a decent bottle of Cabernet, that once it gets reduced down and put into a meat pie, is absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
Okay, it's not, you wasted those bottles of wine. Shame on you.
But we do say never cook with anything you wouldn't drink. But
yeah.
It doesn't have to be the $6,000 bottle of Mouton.
But here's the deal: when you are talking about, you know, the thing that makes Mouton, especially 82 Mouton, is its subtlety, and that is lost in cooking. Hey, listen, we're going to come up. We're going to talk about a less cheery topic. We're going to talk about avian bird flu. Won't that be fun? You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Cafe Lombardi, Stage Left Restaurant. You know, sometimes our shows are upbeat, and sometimes our shows are, well, not exactly upbeat. Wendy Arendt is our guest today. She's written the rather disturbingly titled Plague, the Mysterious Past and Terrifying Future of the World's Most Dangerous Disease. She's an anthropologist and also a science writer. Her work has appeared in The Washington Post, The Sciences, Los Angeles Times, and The American Prospect. In the past year, she's written a series of articles on bird flu and flu pandemics, and that has a lot to do with restaurants and our farmers and food supplies, and that's why we've invited her here to give us the facts on bird flu, poultry, wild birds, and people. Well, Wendy, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
Hi, Wendy. How are you this morning?
I'm just fine. Thank you.
It's my hypothesis that you're going to scare the tar out of us and our listeners.
I hope not.
Well, tell us, let's start with talking about poultry. I mean, you wrote in an article called The Price of Cheap Chicken is Bird Flu. You talk about migratory birds, which a lot of people view as the spreaders of this disease, usually being more the victims than the carriers. Can you talk about that with us?
Well, it's been very common among a number of virologists and officials of the WHO, the World Health Organization, initially anyway, or for a long, long time, to blame the spread of the deadly H5N1 on migratory birds. In other words, the deadly disease got into the wild bird population, who are now flying it all over the globe, and it's going to come down here, and it's going to get into our poultry, and it's going to kill us all. That's been the thinking for a long time.
And your thinking is different.
Well, yeah, for one simple reason. Dead ducks don't fly.
Hmm. So,
okay.
So once they get the bird flu, they're not flying.
They're not flying, they're dying. It is possible that there are some birds that are less susceptible to highly pathogenic, that is very deadly, avian flu.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been a theory that people have had for a while, but no one's ever been able to show us a species which, under normal circumstances, is resistant to this disease and yet is able to pump out infected feces and infect other birds.
That's a really graphic image you just gave us with the pumping out of the feces.
I'm sorry, I know it's a show about food, but this is the ugly side of it.
Well, I'm just glad it's radio. We all have the visual.
So if the birds aren't flying from place to place and transferring this disease from place to place by migration, which is what we've been told and led to believe, how's this passing?
Oh, it's passing through the illegal importation and smuggling of infected birds. People are taking their sick birds and they're getting out of town and they're selling them. And wouldn't you, if that was your entire livelihood?
Well, I thought what was happening was they were paying people for their sick birds in order to, so they wouldn't lose all their money. I mean,
exactly.
I've read a lot of things about that.
Exactly. Exactly. I mean, if you're somebody who's got 10 chickens and they look okay to you, mm-hmm. and somebody's coming to cull them, which is a nice word for it, slaughter them, mm-hmm. bury them alive, burn them, whatever they do to these birds is pretty horrible. Cull is such a nice antiseptic term. But if you know somebody's coming to get your birds and you're not going to get enough money for them or no money at all, what are you going to do? You're going to take your birds and get out of town.
When they cull birds, they don't compensate the farmer?
Some places have compensated them. I think Turkey, there was some compensation. In Thailand, they were getting a third of the bird's value.
Mm-hmm.
This is ridiculous.
Well,
when they get a third of the bird's value, the motivation is then to smuggle the birds, the sick birds, someplace, sell them off rather than lose all your money on your birds.
Right, exactly. And it's not just the small farmers that have been doing this. We can't point out anything that definitive about the large companies, but people have customs has found millions of tons of infected meat on various borders over the last few years.
And the small farmers really aren't doing millions of tons.
Millions of tons of infected meat.
Is this all infected with bird flu, or is it infected with other things?
Or at least it's frozen meat, which seems to have had some bird flu in it. The reports are very, very hard to get.
Now, Ken, when you consume meat that's infected with bird flu, do you contract the disease?
Well, it depends. You're not going to get sick if the meat is cooked.
Uh-huh.
But somebody's got to prepare that meat.
And so, by touching it, by just touching it, you can get bird flu.
Well, yeah, if you put your hands in your mouth or your nose, sure.
Wow. Holy camoly.
So you were right, Francis. She scared me. We're in the first segment of the show, and I'm frightened already.
So where does this disease come from? Where does bird flu come from?
Well, there are many types of bird flu, and most of them are very mild. They circulate in birds. Sorry, I have to go back to the feces again. But wild birds, under normal circumstances, circulate this stuff all the time. They They take it in from infected water. It goes out the other end and on and on and on, and it doesn't affect them.
And most bird flus just aren't that serious.
They're not serious at all. The bird doesn't even know probably that it's discommoded.
But we're talking about the H5N1 virus.
Now, that's a different question. How does a bird flu get to be violently deadly? Well, if you think about the conditions that birds exist in the wild, if a bird is going to get, and this probably happens, I'm sure it happens sometimes, a deadlier strain of this bird flu, it's going to die. It's not flying anywhere. And that's the end of the virulent strain.
You know what? We're going to have to finish with it. We're going to leave you with a cliffhanger here as we go to a commercial break. But we're talking about the birds in the wild are going to fly around, are not going to fly and spread the disease, but maybe the birds in captivity. I think I know where you're going with this. We'll have to see after the break. Our guest is Wendy Arendt. She's written the rather disturbingly titled Plague in the Mysterious Past and Terrifying Future of the World's Most Dangerous Disease. And we're talking right now about the H5N1 bird flu. We'll be talking more with her in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Catherine Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were, you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The matagatta and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or CatherineLombardi.com. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. And you're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left at Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. Our guest today is Wendy Arendt. She's an anthropologist and an expert on bird flu, among other things. And we left with a bit of a cliffhanger. We were talking about how in the wild, a virulent form of bird flu like H5N1 would probably not get widely spread because it would kill wild birds so quickly that they wouldn't have time to spread it. So how does it spread, Wendy?
Well, how does it evolve is really the question. When you pack birds together, as you do in factories, bird factories, where the birds are literally cheek by jowl, if birds have jowls,
mm-hmm.
What happens is the brakes to the virulence are off. There's no price that the virus has to pay by getting so deadly that it kills its host before it finds another host.
Mm-hmm.
So you can evolve terribly lethal viruses that just ramp all through the chicken's body, and then bingo, the next host is right next door, a beak away, and that bird gets a very virulent disease too, and onward and onward and onward. There's not a price to pay as there is for wild birds. If the virus gets into a wild bird and it's very, very deadly, it kills the bird, that's it. You know,
and there's no other bird
in the water.
There's
right.
No other bird in close enough proximity unless it's sharing a nest.
Exactly.
So are modern factory farms more of a problem than, say, the traditional family farm that had, you know, a flock of hundreds of birds?
I don't think a flock of hundreds of birds which are running around a yard is any problem at all. And as far as we know, there's never been a really lethal outbreak under those conditions to begin with. It needs a factory farm to cook.
Well, you know, I've seen advertising out there that's talking about how the factory farms are the safe answer now.
The safe haven. I've seen the same things.
Whereas the factory farms are the problem.
It strikes me that you don't feel that way, Wendy.
Oh, not at all. In fact, it really angers me because we're going to end up getting nothing on our tables but factory-produced chicken because people are trying to scare us away from free-range birds.
So the free-range bird is your safest option.
Well, it's the healthiest bird.
But it's the factory farms that have caused this in a way, is what you're saying?
Absolutely.
And the factory farms are trying to use it to get you to buy only factory farm chicken.
They keep talking about biosecurity. Well, we're going to keep it safe from migratory birds, and that's true.
All right, we have to take a break for the news, but Wendy, we're going to talk more about this right after the news. Wendy Arendt, wonderful book called The Mysteries and Past, Mysterious Past and Terrifying Future of the World's Most Dangerous Disease. We're talking about bird flu and how it affects you, and the misinformations out there that we're trying to correct here on this show. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Captain Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Our guest today is Wendy Arendt. She has written the rather disturbingly titled Plague, the Mysterious Past and Terrifying Future of the World's Most Dangerous Disease. She's an anthropologist and also a science writer. Her works appeared in Discover magazine, The New Republic, The Washington Post. In the past year, she's written a series of articles on bird flu and flu pandemics, and we've invited her here to give us the facts on bird flu, poultry, wild animals, and you. We were talking before the break about how there seems to be a notion out there that the way to stay safe from bird flu is to eat only the factory farm chicken because they're kept inside and shielded from migratory birds, which spread the disease. But
and,
Wendy...
And things like sunlight.
You said...
nasty, nasty things like
but,
that.
But you, I think... Let me see if I can paraphrase what you said in the last half hour of the show. That's sort of like saying the way to keep people away from disease is to take all the people and put them together in one room and make them stay there and not let them bathe.
That's pretty much it. The thing is, if you could have an absolute certainty that every one of your chickens went into that factory farm completely disease-free, it's true. Those birds would be, in some sense, safe. I still wouldn't want to eat them, but they would not be infected. But how can you be sure?
Right.
We've seen this over and over again in Pennsylvania, in California, in Mexico, in the Netherlands. Over and over again in factory farms, that's where you see the rise of virulent birds.
Well, and they're blaming it on the family farmer, saying the family farmer's not safe, and it turns out that it's the agribusiness that is the problem to begin with. Can you talk to us? I hear all these comparisons all the time between, you know, should this H5N1 virus become transmutable human to human easily?
I just want to backtrack for one second. One of the things about bird flu as it stands right now is it can go from bird to human, but not from human to human.
And if that changes, how will this compare with the 1918 pandemic of flu?
Well, that's an excellent question. The easy answer and the short answer is that we don't know. But I think that logically, if we use evolutionary theory, we can make a fairly good prediction. First of all, the phrase we keep hearing is mutate to transmissibility. The bird flu is going to mutate to transmissibility, and suddenly it'll be spread, and suddenly we'll have a pandemic. In fact, diseases do not work that way.
Mm-hmm.
There would be a number of steps that's necessary for the bird flu to go through. And it can before it becomes transmissible, and that cannot happen in the context of chickens. It can only happen in a human context as the bird flu adapts and passes from person to person to person. First of all, we know that the bird flu itself only adheres to certain. Tell me if I'm getting too technical here.
No, fine. That's great.
There are certain receptors in our respiratory tract. Some of them are bird-like, and some of them are mammalian. Now, obviously, they're all mammalian because we have them, but there are certain ones that are considered to be more like the receptor cells in the tract, the respiratory tract of birds, and those are hairy cells or ciliated cells. They have, you know, if you looked at a picture of them, they actually look like they're covered with hair.
Mm-hmm.
And the function of these, again, this is not a delicious topic, but it moves mucus out of your lungs and, you know, keeps your lungs clear. That's
right.
What the hairs are for. But the bird flu can stick onto these hairs, these hairy cells, and that's how it gets into the body.
Okay.
But the interesting thing is the hairy cells are deep in your lungs. This means that if you get a big, huge dose from chickens, and that's what it would take, a big, huge dose of this, and it gets down deep into your lungs, you can get very, very sick. But if it's down deep into your lungs, you can't cough it off, it out.
Mm.
So there's a kind of mechanical barrier right now to prevent it from going to person
so
to person.
So what would have to change for it to go to person to person?
Well, it would have to learn to infect, and this has actually happened in a couple of cases. People have shown evidence of the of birds being able, the flu strain being able to adapt to human cells up higher in the respiratory tract. But it would have to happen all the time, and people would have to be coughing this stuff out all the time, and it would have to go from person to person to person to person. Now, if it moves up into the upper respiratory tract and infects the cells there, you have, by definition, a milder disease.
Mm-hmm.
So what we think would actually happen is what happens to every flu strain, except 1918, and I'll get to that in a second. But every other normal flu strain requires you to go around and cough and sneeze in your neighbor's face and shake hands with him generously donate your virus to him in any way you can think of.
Uh-huh.
And as long as you do that, as long as you remain mobile, the strain you're passing out is, by definition, not a terribly deadly one.
Right, because you're walking.
Because you're walking around shaking hands and
exactly.
coughing on people.
And you know, people always say, well, you can transmit it before you're sick. And with flu, that's really not true. The transmission that you can produce before you have symptoms is minimal because it's the symptoms that get the bird flu out.
See, look, now you're actually making me feel better.
So what happened in 1918?
Yes. 1918 was exactly the same as the chicken farms. If you can think of a chicken factory farm of men, this was, or conversely, think of the Western Front these are both disease factories. The chicken factory farms and the Western Front are disease
and
factories.
And a trench filled with men.
Filled with men, but it's not crowding that's the issue. It's not just the fact that the people are close together, because we have this all over the world today, and we still never see virulent flu. The fact is you need people that are packed so closely together so that people who are immobilized by illness, knocked flat out on the floor, and unable to move, are still able to transmit to people over and over again.
Because you're still next to them.
Yes, and these people, the sick people, were taken out and put in hospital trucks and, you know, along with the wounded and trucked all over the Western Front. So you had, if you wanted the perfect conditions for breeding a more and more virulent flu, 1918 was it. And this
wow.
was discovered by Paul Ewald, the great evolutionary biologist at the University of Louisville.
So do you think that the fears of a pandemic from bird flu are overblown?
Well, I think a pandemic is possible. I don't think it's very likely, or I think it would have happened by now.
Mm-hmm.
Pandemics are not something cyclical. The idea that we're overdue for a new one is nonsense. They happen when they happen, and
so,
we don't know why. But no, I think a pandemic could happen. I don't think a lethal pandemic could happen.
So tell us about your book, Plague, and the topic of your book, Plague, and how that differs from bird flu.
Well, plague is plague. I mean, it's the deadliest disease in human history. But the good thing about it is that it's so deadly that it doesn't stay a human disease.
Mm-hmm.
That is to say, when plague actually, under the right circumstances, gets into the human population and begins to cycle, it can be far worse than anything we can imagine. When we talk about the 1918 flu as a lethal flu, we're talking about something that killed between 2.5 and 5% of those infected. With plague, if you're talking about pneumonic plague in the days before antibiotics, 99.9% of those infected died.
Wow.
I mean, it was a hideous disease, and this was the Black Death.
And so is there a possibility that plague could again come into the human population?
Only under conditions of a bioterrorist attack.
Uh-huh.
There's really absolutely no way that I can imagine a plague epidemic breaking out that would prove it. You might have local problems, but nothing worldwide.
Nothing on a worldwide catastrophe.
No, absolutely
that
not. Plague is a terribly scary thing, but it's really only scary when you think about the Soviets having, you know, weaponized this thing and turned it into a truly, truly terrible, it's terrible as an atomic bomb, probably.
I guess any time I think about something like that, though, with somebody weaponizing a plague or something like that, wouldn't there have to be an antidote? Or
Oh, yes, there is. Oh, yeah. They're not stupid. They made it antibiotic resistant to 10 different antibiotics, but they knew damn well which one it was sensitive to.
Mm-hmm.
And there are still stockpiles of this around?
I doubt it.
Yeah.
The knowledge is still there.
Right.
But the thing about plague is that, if some crazy person listening to me now decided they wanted to go west and dig up some prairie dog plague, don't do it. You'll kill yourself before you'll kill anybody else.
Right.
Prairie dog plague would not make a good bioweapon. You have to use the right strain of plague, the same strain that almost certainly or very, very likely caused the Black Death, which is marmot plague strains from Central Asia. They're sort of kick-started to kill people. Because they cause pneumonic disease in the marmot. A marmot is, it's like a giant. Woodchuck is our American marmot, but they have these huge marmots over there that live in giant colonies, and they really have a terrible kind of plague.
Well, our topic today is not cheery, but it's very informative, and our guest today is Wendy Orent. Her book is titled Plague, The Mysterious Past and Terrifying Future of the World's Most Dangerous Disease. This is an entirely separate topic from bird flu, which we are also talking about, which there's actually, sounds like a little bit of good news of beyond the hysteria that we have out there. We'll be talking with her more in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45. Hi, this is Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants and also of the Restaurant Guys radio show. You know, one of the best things about the restaurant business is the creative side of it. Coming up with big ideas and then turning those concepts into reality is awesome. It's what I love most about what I do. But it can't stop there. If you can't communicate exactly what it is you're doing, then you'll find yourself standing alone in your dining room, just you and your big ideas. The Mardini Group can help you get your ideas across to others. The Mardini Group is a boutique graphic design firm, and they do extraordinary work. We use them, and as you know, we only use the best. Whether it's menu design, product packaging, a corporate report, promo material, a homepage, or an awesome logo for a brand new project like Catherine Lombardi, we turn to the Mardini Group. Some small business owners don't realize how important it is to have a strong visual identity. Without it, you come across as less than professional. That can cost you trust, and that lowers your bottom line. First impressions count for a lot, and that's why you need the Mardini Group. Go to RestaurantGuysRadio.com and click on the Mardini Group link, or call them at 718-694-9944. The Mardini Group for graphic design, 718-694-9944.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hi, we're back with the Restaurant Guys. You're listening to Mark and Francis. We are talking today with Wendy Arendt. She is an anthropologist and a science writer. Her work appears in Discover Magazine, the New Republic, the Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, and in the last year she's written a series of articles on bird flu and flu pandemics. We've invited her here to give us a talk on exactly what's going on with the bird flu, and we found some interesting information. Let me ask you a two-pronged question. One is, where is the origin man-made of bird flu, of H5N1, do you think?
Well, of course, the strains come from nature, but the virulence of this disease is very definitely man-made and has to do with the factory farm conditions in which the birds were raised. So in that sense, absolutely, all high pathogenic, as far as we know, all high pathogenic bird flus are man-made.
So what do we do now to convince farmers to turn in birds that might be sick, or what do we do there?
Well, of course, the bird flu is not here. This strain of bird flu is not in the United States. As far as if it does come in...
Mm-hmm, that's what I'm talking about.
My God. It could only come in, I think, through smuggled poultry. It's very unlikely it's going to come in through migratory birds.
So the news we're hearing about that whole migration, birds coming here, going to come to Alaska first and then work its way down the coast, is you believe to be...
Bunk.
I believe it to be bunk.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, now should something like that come to the United States... I'm remembering that the way that we dealt with the swine flu in 1976. I mean, how do you think that the government can deal with something like this? Or do you think the government's set to make any great missteps in how they are dealing with it?
Well, they will be if they repeat 1976. Now, 1976 turned out to be a disastrous error, but not because the scientists who thought of it and who were convinced about it, its threat, were incompetent or anything really other than superb scientists. They, on the basis of what they knew, it was a sound and sane decision.
Why don't you tell us about what happened in 76 and what went wrong with it?
Okay, well, in 1976, people then, I talked to Dr. Kilbourne, Edwin Kilbourne, the really, truly great flu virologist of the time, who was convinced, he told me, that in those days that bird flu was cyclical, that pandemic human flu was cyclical, and that you got a pandemic about every 10 to 11 years. And when they saw evidence, there was a young soldier at Fort Dix who fell ill and died of flu, and they looked at the strain and they saw that it was an H1N1 similar to that of 1918,
mm-hmm.
a descendant of that, and it may have come from pigs. They became terrified, and they thought that a new pandemic was upon us and that they had to protect the American people by vaccinating everyone. So they rushed a vaccine into production using the very sound methods that they've been using for a long time, the egg-based cultural methods.
Mm-hmm.
And they developed a vaccine, and they vaccinated 40 million Americans. It's difficult to determine how many people came down with paralysis, but it looks like it may be as many as 1,000 people were paralyzed from
vaccine.
Yeah.
And that at least 50 people are known to have died of this
Right.
Disease.
So what went wrong there? What went awry?
Well, who knows? It was a side effect of the vaccine.
Yeah.
And those are maybe acceptable risks if you've got a
if you're in the middle
like
of a real pandemic.
That's right. Yeah, but I know that it's very disturbing to the people involved in the 1976 outbreak to know that, you know, there were 40 million people vaccinated for no reason and 50 people who died for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
And that's very troubling.
So what?
So if bird flu comes to the United States, do you think that we should start a vaccination program, that we should be pre-vaccinating?
No, absolutely not.
What's the sound policy that the government should be following at this point?
Well, first of all, we don't know what the disease would look like, because if it does adapt to human beings, and I do want to stress that that's possible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It is possible that a human form of this could evolve under the right circumstances.
But you think
that
would be
watching.
But you think it would be less potent if it adapted?
Oh, totally, absolutely, mm-hmm. It would have to be by definition. Unless we were planning to launch another, you know, World War I and we have trench warfare again.
Right.
I would like to see them develop a vaccine as soon as it became evident what the disease would actually look like.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd like them to stockpile it, because we don't want people to have a strain of flu. This might be nasty. I don't know. It could be like 1957, which did kill quite a number of Americans, because they had no immunity to it. Or it might be, there's something to remember about this. It's H5N1. And the N1 has been, a related protein has been circulating for a long time, because one of the current strains now is H1N1.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of us have already been exposed to N1 proteins, and we have some immunity. So we might really get a very, very mild pandemic if this thing became pandemic. It's impossible to say.
Well, despite all the disturbing things we've talked about, Wendy, I think that we actually have some good news, and I think there's less reason to be hysterical, especially less reason to be hysterical about buying from free-ranging poultry from family farms. And we're going to link our listeners to your information on the web, and also to your book, which is an interesting read nonetheless. Plague: The Mysterious Past and Terrifying Future of the World's Most Dangerous Disease, and a number of your articles that we'll also link to on bird flu. So thanks for coming to take the time to talk with us.
Thanks, it was a real pleasure.
Thanks, Wendy.
All right, thank you.
Well, I'm going to breathe a little bit easier.
But
isn't it so typical? I mean, the big agribusiness causes a problem and then blames it on the small farmer and says this is the reason that you should buy big agribusiness. They've got the advertising dollars, and they've got the media in their pocket, and it's just crazy. Well, we're here to spread a little truth on the Restaurant Guys. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis. That was a rather disturbing show that we had.
It was less disturbing than I thought it was going to be, for a number of reasons. I think Wendy hopefully allayed a lot of people's fears about the fact that a disease like that, first of all, is likely not to come to the United States unless it's smuggled here.
Right.
And the fact that it would be very, very difficult for bird flu to humanize, for you to be able to get it anywhere except from birds, which the bird flu can be cooked away. So it's not as dangerous a thing, I think, as the media would have you believe.
Well, and the other thing is, she says that if it does mutate to humanize, which means it'll move from the lower respiratory tract to the upper respiratory tract, that it will become less potent and less virulent. And that's, you know...
Which are very important things. And, you know, Francis, whenever we're talking about something like this, I just find that the media plays something like this up when it's in their best interest to sell newspapers or to make you watch the news.
But not just their best interest, Mark. I mean, look at the ultimate irony here. When it's in the media's interest, when it's in agribusiness's interest to hype up hysteria about how you shouldn't be eating free-ranging birds from small farmers, but should be eating their factory chickens, which is exactly the wrong way to work against.
Right. It sounds to me like that's the opposite. And from speaking to the experts, and I'm not offering my opinion here, because I'm always going to go for the free-range bird that's raised appropriately, as opposed to a bird that's cooked in a factory, it is cooked in a factory farm, that's grown in a factory farm. And it sounds to me from listening to Wendy, like that's the right course of action. That's still the right course of action.
But the threat doesn't come from wild birds. The threat doesn't come from birds out in the yard. The threat comes from tightly packed corporate agribusiness farms where they're incubators for disease. Now, let's just look at one thing. We reported on mad cow disease. It's in agribusiness interest to have mad cow disease underreported because if people start shying away from beef, they're in a lot of trouble. And that's what happens. Mad cow disease is underreported. It's in agribusiness interest to have the hysteria about bird flu overreported, and that's what happens. And I find that very interesting. Very, very interesting.
Well, I'm just glad that we can keep eating poultry and that we don't have to worry as much about this as the media would have you believe.
Well, I hope that you'll come back for a more chipper show tomorrow.
We promise more chipper tomorrow.
And I don't know if you've enjoyed the hour, but I hope that you've learned something. And I really do hope that you've enjoyed listening to the Restaurant Guys for this hour. I am Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.